May God bless the United States of America, and God bless Boeing.
That was then a speech last year, grounded is now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, today, the 13th day of March 2019. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It took 4 days, and it happened in spite of a call from Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg to President Trump yesterday morning. But the Federal Aviation Administration said today that Boeing's 737 MAX 8 aircraft are not welcome in American skies unless and until the company figures out what is going on with that plane and then fixes it. And that decision sets a whole bunch of things in motion. Blaine Nickerson is managing editor at AirlineReporter.com. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
You surprised it took the FAA this long?
I'm surprised it took them this long, and frankly, I'm surprised at how disjointed this whole regulatory action has been.
Say more about that.
Well, you know, I mean, it's very strange to see somebody like the European authorities get out in front of the American authorities on an American-built plane. And just, you know, this sort of cascading event of different airlines and different countries and different regulatory authorities all having a domino effect to the point where really, you know, Canada this morning and then the FAA this afternoon, they just really didn't have any more choice. There was too much concern in the public realm.
Now that these planes have been grounded, there has to be some way that Boeing can get them ungrounded. What does Boeing have to do? What's the fix going to have to be?
Well, that's the problem, Kai, is we don't know what the problem is. Now, I do think that they'll figure some things out pretty quickly. The Ethiopians decided to send the so-called black boxes to the German authorities to have them examine them. And within, you know, a couple of days, I would think that they're going to be able to take a look at the data and essentially have an idea. Is this like the crash that brought down the Lion airplane, or was it something completely different? And I think that'll really dictate what's going to happen next.
Airlines have huge logistical problems out of this, right? They're going to have to reposition planes and figure out how to get their paying customers where they need to be. Boeing, it seems to me, has a more upstream problem, right? They've got something like 5,000 orders for this plane. This is their moneymaker, right? And now, I mean, are they going to stop making it while this investigation goes on? Because they got nowhere to sell it to.
That's a great question, Kai. And who knows if they can even fly them away from their factory in Renton. Boeing's got a big problem here. They've only got about 40-something of the prior generation 737 still left in the pipeline. And they produce 52 of these 737 jets a month.
Wow.
You know, almost one and a half every day.
Wow.
They're very limited on space at their Renton airport. And so either they're going to have to stop production, or they're going to have to find a way to get approval to fly these things away to a parking lot somewhere. And that really can have huge impacts for the 12,000 workers in that plant.
Right. So the 787, the Dreamliner, had those batteries that caught fire a couple of five, 6 years ago. Now we've got the 737 MAX 8 having its problems. Boeing is working on a new plane, sometimes called the 797. One would assume this could not come at a worse time for the world's biggest commercial airplane maker.
Boeing, it's, you know, was widely expected that they were going to be making an announcement, maybe even this spring, about engaging customers in orders for that 797 or new midsize airplane.
Right.
You know, they've got a track record now of the last two planes they've launched have been grounded for safety issues. And in, you know, aviation is such a safety-aware environment that Boeing genuinely has a serious problem.
We should, just on the way out here, we should be clear here. Commercial aviation is extraordinarily safe.
Absolutely. You know, flying has never been safer. And, you know, while we have two tragic incidents, they're isolated incidents, and we still don't know the cause of the second one.
Yeah.
So to jump to a conclusion that we've got some type of a systematic failure is a really hard jump for me.
Blaine Nickerson is the managing editor at AirlineReporter.com. I should say on the way out of here that we have called Boeing a couple of times to try to get CEO Dennis Muilenburg back on the air. I talked to him a month or two ago, maybe in Chicago. We've got that interview on our website, marketplace.org. Blaine, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, Kai.
Related but different, a handful of us here at Marketplace are going to be on a Boeing jet in 10 days or so, a 787, as it happens, headed to London to make economic sense of the political mess that is Brexit. Send us your questions before we go, what you want to know. Also, and this is important, what you are sick and tired of about Brexit. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org. Also, and not for nothing, I should say one more thing here Brexit-wise. In the Votapalooza that is the British Parliament in these waning days before the UK is scheduled to leave the European Union Friday, 29 March, lawmakers over there voted today that a no-deal Brexit, that is to say just leaving with no trade treaties or anything else in place, they said that is not okay. So there is going to be another vote tomorrow on whether to just put the whole thing off for a while. Stay tuned, I think is the phrase. On Wall Street today, fine, thanks. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One thing the whole college admissions scandal that broke yesterday has made even more clear is that there is a whole lot that is not clear at all about the admissions process. And that lack of clarity is, in part, the cause of a whole lot of anxiety out there about getting into college, especially at schools in the top rank. The schools mentioned yesterday that don't accept 90, sometimes 95%, 96-point-something percent of the students who apply. Problem is, those schools don't have much of an incentive to change or, in fact, to explain. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports now on whether this scandal could change that.
When Elizabeth Heaton worked as an admissions officer at the University of Pennsylvania, one of her colleagues had a saying.
Sometimes you're a tuba player in a piccolo year.
What she meant was that some years Penn's band might really need a tuba player. So if you play tuba and have good grades, you might have a really good shot of getting in. But the next year may belong to the piccolo player or the pole vaulter or the classics major from Wyoming. Heaton, who's now a private admissions coach, says every school every year has a different wish list.
So it's always shifting slightly as the institution's priorities shift. And I do believe that's one of the reasons why it will be very difficult to ever get complete transparency.
That social engineering is called shaping a class. And former guidance counselor Lloyd Thacker says it gives colleges cover to pretty much admit whomever they want, like legacy students or the children of wealthy donors. But Thacker says colleges have a mission to serve the public good. And if they're turning down a qualified student in favor of a less qualified one with mad pole vaulting skills,
that's a judgment call, and I guess I'm calling into question the judgments that are being made.
Thacker says the cheating scandal could prompt some soul-searching by elite schools, but probably not much more. John Boshoven is co-director of counseling at Ann Arbor Public Schools in Michigan. He encourages families not to get stuck on the handful of colleges that get all the attention and consider schools that might be a better fit for their child.
Parents are panicking because we didn't have to go through all this when we applied to college, because we looked at colleges near where we lived that met our needs that we could afford.
There are more than 4,000 colleges in the U.S., and most of them are pretty clear about what it takes to get in. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Learning a new language can be tricky. There's a memorization thing, sometimes a grammar thing. It can be a grind thing a lot. But now there's an app for that. Duolingo is the invention of a guy by the name of Louis von Ahn. Also, as it happens, the guy behind those CAPTCHA things where you have to prove you're not a robot. Duolingo is a free language learning app, the trick to which is that it makes learning those languages feel like playing a game. Duolingo as a business, though, is very much not a game. It's got 300 million users worldwide. It's a $700 million company. And Louis von Ahn, not only the co-founder, he's also the CEO. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
When you were trying to raise money for this thing, what was the elevator pitch? What did you go out to your funders, your venture capitalists, and say?
Well, it depends on which round of funding, but I mean, in the earlier rounds.
Let's start the first round, you know, the early rounds when you were still trying to figure out what it was.
Yeah, in the earlier rounds, you know, we hadn't even really launched an app or anything. We basically just said, look, Duolingo is going to be a free way to learn languages. At the time, most of the ways there were to learn a language like Rosetta Stone were extremely expensive. And there's this weirdness where most of the people trying to learn a language in the world are actually trying to do so in order to get out of poverty. So it was basically the idea was to try to come up with a free way to teach languages that was also effective.
And what's the gimmick is not the right word, but what's the pivot point? What's the thing you found that makes it work in an app and in this company?
I think a number of things. I think probably the first thing was early on we realized that the hardest thing about learning a language by yourself is, or learning anything by yourself, is keeping yourself motivated. Mm. It's very easy to start, just like going to the gym, but it's very hard to stick with it. So quickly we started making Duolingo feel as much like a game as possible. So we've spent, in fact, years now perfecting this. So when you start using Duolingo, we use a lot of different game mechanics that keep you motivated. I think that has been a big thing. The fact that it's been free also has been a big thing and has allowed us to grow a lot. And because of that, by now, Duolingo is the most popular way to learn languages across the world. We have more people actively learning languages on Duolingo in the United States than there are people learning languages in the whole U.S. public school system, for example. Huh.
One of the things that interested me, actually, as I was reading up on Duolingo, is that some of the lessons, some portion, not small of the lessons, are drawn up by volunteers and people who are or were users and now contribute to it. And it's Wikipedia-ish, in a sense.
It's true. What we've done is, particularly for the smaller languages, I mean, we teach a ton of languages in Duolingo. Some of them are very large, like Spanish, and a lot of people want to learn them. There are some that are smaller in audience. You can think of Navajo or Hawaiian or Swedish or even Klingon. For some of these smaller ones, it just made a lot more sense for us as a business to ask for volunteer contributors. You know, we say, hey, we don't have the resources really to build a Hawaiian course. But if anybody from, our audience would like to add a Hawaiian course, here are tools that we use to add courses to Duolingo. We've opened them up. So if you want to help us, go ahead. And that's what has allowed us to really increase the number of languages that we teach from, three or four very large ones to, 30 plus.
If you're a free service, right, I can download the app and get going right away. How are you making money?
One of the things about Duolingo, so we do make money, but we really wanted to make it be the case that it is always possible to learn the entirety of our content, even if you don't have, a credit card. So that's a basic mission for the company. But there are other ways to make money. So, for example, we have so many users that we can make tens of millions of dollars by just putting an ad at the end of every lesson. So that's one way. We also now have a subscription service that you can pay. And it does a few things. We don't charge you for the content, but it does a few things. First of all, it turns off the ads. But it also gives you access to a few kind of extra features. And that is Duolingo Plus, and that makes even more money than the ads.
Are you a user? What language are you studying?
I am a user. I'm studying two. I've gotten pretty good at Portuguese.
That's not fair, right? Because it's kind of close to Spanish. So
people say that, but this is one
yes,
of the
we
weirdest
do.
Things about Portuguese. Portuguese and Spanish is one of the weirdest relationships. Every Portuguese speaker, for some reason, already know Spanish. Like, for them, learning Spanish is very easy. The other way around is actually much harder.
Huh.
So Spanish speakers to Portuguese is actually much harder because
the
pronunciation
get
is just
at me
a lot
about
harder.
That. Yeah.
So that one is one. Yeah. And then French. I'm an intermediate French speaker, although my accent is and pronunciation is just absolutely terrible.
Luis Van Aan, he's the CEO and one of the co-founders of Duolingo. Thanks a lot for your time, Luis. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Duolingo is not just limited to English or Spanish or French or Portuguese. You can do fictional languages as well, including High Valyrian, which will be familiar to Game of Thrones fans out there. We spoke with the linguist who developed it. You can read more about how he did it at marketplace.org. Coming up.
You're looking at $200, $209 a veil just to go out and try it for a day and get cold and frustrated.
Au contraire, skiing can be fun, but yes, it's expensive. First, though, let's do the numbers. All right, so here you go on a Wednesday. Dow Industrial is up 148 points, about 0.5%, 25,702. The NASDAQ gained 52 points, about 0.6%, 76.43. The S&P 500 up 19.7%, 28 and 10. There, Boeing was up for the first time in 7 days, despite that 737 MAX news. Shares up 0.4% since the crash, by the way, on Sunday. Boeing has lost more than $26 billion in market value. Build-A-Bear, the teddy bear maker, rose a 0.1% today after posting fourth quarter loss. The company blamed weak sales in North America and also, yes, Brexit for its woes. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.62%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Of the common macroeconomic refrains in this country right now, the idea of a super tight labor market is probably the most common. Unemployment is at just 3.8% at the moment, so a lot of companies are having a tough time finding the workers they need. And among the most desperate are trucking companies. The American Trucking Associations, plural in the original, by the way, associations, they figure we are 60,000 truck drivers short nationwide, and they say that gap is likely to grow with baby boomers retiring and younger people reluctant to take on the long hours and weeks away from home life that long-haul trucking can bring. They are reluctant, even though pay can go upwards of $80,000 a year. From our bureau in Portland, Oregon, Mitchell Hartman has that one.
Tamer Mechevaryani just pulled his tractor-trailer into this busy Travel Centers of America truck stop off I-84 east of Portland. He's just 27, which makes him a bit of an outlier among the mostly middle-aged men here to refuel or grab a bite to eat before hitting the road again. He's worked a lot of blue-collar jobs, and driving a truck?
I love it. You're basically on your own time, your own boss. You're driving. Nobody is forcing you to do anything like manual labor.
The industry is going to need to recruit a lot more young people like Mechevaryani to reverse the nationwide shortage of long-haul truck drivers. Leonard Stair is a 20-year veteran trucker and represents the Teamsters Union in Central Oregon. He pitches trucking at youth career fairs, but he doesn't sugarcoat his message.
You're away from home a lot, working on nights, you're working weekends.
What's the upside?
The compensation is great. If you want to just stay out on the road all the time, you can make between $80,000 and $120,000 a year.
Trucking companies are now offering higher wages to boost recruitment and retention. Wayne Cederholm is with Salt Lake City-based CR England, which has 7,000 drivers nationwide. He says the company has rearranged driver schedules to give them more predictability and time off the road. And over the past 8 months,
we've invested over $30 million in annual driver pay. It could be a couple hundred plus a week more, several thousand more a year.
Truckers' median base pay has increased more than 5% just in the last year, according to job site Glassdoor. Wages are up much more than in other blue-collar occupations like construction. But wages need to be higher still to restore truck driving's former economic clout and attract new drivers, says Wayne State University economist Michael Belzer.
Trucking began to experience a shortage of drivers in the mid-1980s after deregulation, after compensation dropped by about a third.
Belzer says if pay had kept up with inflation, the typical long-haul driver would be making about $120,000 a year now.
What you have is a shortage of compensation and intensification of working conditions, and the job is not attractive enough to draw people into the industry to stay.
Economist Bob Costello at the American Trucking Associations says, sure, really big pay hikes could bring in new recruits and help with the driver shortage.
But is that $150,000 a year? Is it $200,000 a year? That's really sort of unrealistic.
Pay isn't the only obstacle to getting more people to sign up for a life on the road. Teamsters rep Leonard Stair says if he were just starting out today,
I would be in a lot of uncertainty how stable and secure my job would be due to the advent of the autonomous vehicles.
Self-driving trucks being developed by Daimler, Tesla, and others could transform the long-haul trucking business. And Stair doesn't think companies will pay very much to have someone sit in the cab and monitor the controls while the truck drives itself. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
So here's a deceptively simple idea for a business from way, way back that has become a whole way of life here in the modern age. Strap a couple of pieces of wood to your feet, fiberglass now, I guess, and point yourself down a snowy mountain. Used to be you went to a ski place, you bought a lift ticket, and you skied your heart out for the day. Now, though, there's a whole new thing. Multi-mountain passes from a couple of big ski conglomerates, because that's a real thing now, big ski. Kyle Stock wrote about the business realities of the skiing industry in the late 2010s recently for Bloomberg. Good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
So give me the business model motivation behind this, because we ought to stipulate here, skiing is tough, and in the past couple of years, things have changed.
Yeah, basically, for the longest time, people who owned ski resorts were either families who had a lot of money that could weather some bad winters, and private equity or real estate investors who were in it to kind of sell condos or hotel rooms. And then Vail Resorts came along. It was bought out of bankruptcy, and their approach was kind of different. Starting in mid-90s, they basically said, hey, we can make money just off the skiing if we do it right.
And doing it right means what?
It basically means, you know, size matters. They realized there were some benefits to scale. Specifically, you know, if they owned resorts in different parts of the world, they could kind of hedge winter, hedge their snow risk, if you will. So if they weren't getting snow in Vermont, you know, maybe the resorts in Colorado are getting it, or California. And then there's this kind of network effect that they got in grouping these mountains together, which they do with the season pass. And it's been a stock market darling for almost a decade now.
There's another company out there, too, that we ought to mention, because there's these two big ones, right? It's Vail and then this company called Alterra, run by a guy who used to run Mammoth up here in Central California.
Yeah, and this is kind of the new kid on the block. So basically, this guy that ran Mammoth, Rusty Gregory, super gregarious guy, knows everyone in the business, talked to some of his buddies and got a big private equity firm called KSL together, and just rolled up 12 of these resorts overnight into one big company.
Giant company, yeah. So that's the corporate level. Let me take this down to the individual skier level. So one of these passes from either of these companies runs me $600-$800 plus or minus, right? And if I'm an all-in skier, that's a great deal. But if what they're trying to do is get new people onto the mountains, which I think you kind of have to do to keep things going, and a lift pass, I mean, I don't know how much it is at Mammoth now, but it's certainly not less than like $125-$130, which is a big whack if you're taking, you know, the family up there.
Yeah, and the tricky thing is, you know, they really want to sell these passes. So both these companies at these resorts are ticking up the price of a daily lift ticket to kind of nudge people into buying the season-long all-you-can-eat deal, which is great if you ski a lot, but if you're just trying to pick the sport up, you're looking at $200, $209 at Vail just to go out and try it for a day and get cold and frustrated. So the knock is they're sort of catering to the core and kind of leaving behind what may be the future of the sport or the growth of the sport.
Right. Let me make the Amazon analogy here, right? You've got these two giant companies. What happens to the mountains that say they want to stay independent? Can they survive?
There's not a lot left, honestly. What Alterra's done is they've partnered rather than purchased a lot of these places. You know, if these business models bear out, these companies can get some synergy with their technology, with their purchasing, with their financing, and they're able to pour more money back into the mountain and build better lifts, build better restaurants, build better lodges, and then, you know, gradually over time, theoretically, some of these places get to be much more of a draw than the scrappy local mom-and-pop mountain.
Kyle Stokes, senior correspondent at Bloomberg, writing about skiing. Hey, do you ski? Would you buy one of these passes?
I do, Kai, yeah. I was on the fence this year. I probably should have, to tell you the truth.
Do you ski out west or do you ski back east? Because that's not the same skiing, man.
Yeah, a little bit of both. I was just in Jackson Hole for a week.
Oh, there you go.
All the locals are extra irritated this year because the mountains are swamped, they say.
Huh.
It looks like because of the economy, because of a lot of really good snow everywhere, and because of these new passes that a lot of these resorts are getting kind of deluged with visitors.
Right.
So,
Kyle Stock of Bloomberg, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, you never know till you ask department. Saw this on Business Insider today. Greg Foran, the president and CEO of Walmart U.S., stood up at a company meeting a couple of years ago and asked employees to email him with the best examples they could think of where the company had cut costs but really hadn't saved anything big picture-wise. He got 2,700 emails, Fran says, the number one issue where, in Fran's words, they had cut muscle, not fat, getting rid of toilet seat covers in the restrooms. Gotta ask, right? Holy cow, look at the time. We gotta go. Wall Street today, we're a little squeezed for time. Let's just say it was up about 0.5% or so across the board. Media production team includes Sarah Breguer, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai. I have plenty of time. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.